Dr. Bernie Wilkinson.
And I'm Dr. Richard Marshall.
Happy Friday. Are you attentive today?
Attentive?
Are you paying attention today?
I am fully attentive.
Are you fully? Well, that's good, because today we're going to talk a little bit about ADHD.
Yes, I have to talk about ADHD today.
Just a smidge. We'll just talk about it a little bit.
We're going to introduce this topic.
Yeah.
Because we might talk about it additionally some other time.
It deserves a lot of talking.
It does.
But we...
Alarming... Yes. It deserves a lot. There's some alarming news coming out about ADHD.
Yeah.
So we want to share that with you this morning.
Yeah, well, this kind of just was triggered by a article we read from a couple weeks ago about the role of big pharma and pharmaceutical companies in the diagnosis and prevalence of ADHD. And we found this investigative journalist, Alan Schwartz, has written a little bit about it and talked about it.
Yeah, this is the same guy who highlighted the concussions
right.
in the NFL.
Yeah.
So the same investigative journalist who brought that to national attention finished that project and said needed something else to do. And he said he was made aware of college students snorting Adderall in preparation for tests.
Right.
Okay. And he thought that strange. And so he thought, well, maybe that's a project, maybe that's something I ought to look into.
Right.
So he has done this investigative work about the, I guess you'd call it the abuse.
Right.
Of what started as an article about the abuse of stimulant medication that then led him to an analysis of the prescribing of these medications, or over-prescribing or prescribing of these medications.
Right, and in this little paper that I'll put a link to in the show notes, you know, he talks about Keith Connors,
right,
and how back in the 60s and 70s, he was working with and started some of those early research studies with Ritalin and mm-hmm. talking about that, and you know, we know Keith Connors very well,
right.
not personally, but professionally as far
right.
as his work goes, because mm-hmm. it was really groundbreaking in switching
yeah.
our, and shifting our perspective of what ADHD is mm-hmm. from minimal brain dysfunction to what we really call ADHD today.
Right.
And he's developed some really important rating scales and tools and instruments that we use to assess ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And in here he says that even Keith Connors is saying that what's happening now is a little extreme. It's a problem.
Right. There has always been this suspicion that, two suspicions. One is that ADHD really doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, that these are
right.
just rambunctious kids and they should be allowed to be kids. There is no such thing as ADHD. And many professional therapists and psychologists question whether it's a real diagnosis or not. We don't question the validity of the diagnosis.
Right.
You and I, the research, the world that we came from, our training and experience and background, suggests very clearly that there are indeed brain changes in the brain
right.
that can result in behaviors that we now refer to as ADHD.
Right.
These are brain-based neurodevelopmental disorders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for us, there's no question that this really does exist. And that properly diagnosed, accurately diagnosed, these children and adults will respond to stimulant medication treatment.
Right.
It's a positive and effective way of managing this disorder.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, but the issue is, and as we received in our training, you know, the information that is available suggests that many of the treatments that we use for ADHD, including medications, will have an effect on people even if they don't have
That's right.
ADHD. It'll affect them, and they talk in here about mm-hmm. you know, individuals who don't have ADHD using Adderall and other stimulant medications to help them on the SATs and things like
right.
that, because these medications do stimulate areas of the brain that will potentially lead to more attention and more concentration
right.
whether you have ADHD or not. Now,
right.
for those who don't have ADHD, it does lead to the risk for abuse and certainly using it when you don't have a diagnosis, using it in those situations certainly is a type of abuse.
That's right.
But it's the fact that, you know, we look at efficacy as a validation for treatment or for the diagnosis, and that probably isn't the way that we should be thinking about it. We shouldn't be thinking that, oh, well, because he responds positively to the medication, that confirms my diagnosis of ADHD.
That's right.
And there are people who do that.
Well, if he responds, then he must have ADHD.
Right. You know?
We should probably avoid that. I mean, we should do a thorough diagnosis,
right,
make sure that's what we're dealing with. We talked the other day about children with OCD,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
look like ADHD.
Right.
Kids who are depressed can look like ADHD.
Right.
Kids who have underlying mood disorders and anxiety disorders, they can present with all the same symptoms of ADHD. Oppositional defiant disorder.
Yeah.
You know, very often looks like ADHD.
Right.
But so you have to be very careful about making a very thorough differential diagnosis.
Right.
Once you've made that diagnosis, then you move on to treatment.
Yeah.
Medication, non-medication.
Well, and I think this is a great place to bring up something we mentioned yesterday as far as parity goes.
Right.
Because the reality is that the methods that we can use to make a thorough diagnosis is
right,
limited by what insurance companies and different funding groups allow.
Right.
I was trying to get approval from an insurance company a couple months ago to do a comprehensive right, evaluation on a student to make sure or verify or identify a diagnosis of ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance company says, "Oh no, we won't reimburse for that
mm-hmm,
diagnosis or that CPT code,
right,
that procedural code,
yeah,
for ADHD. We only use it for neurobehavioral disorders."
Right.
And I said, "Well,
that's what this
ADHD is, a neurobehavioral disorder." And they said,
right,
"Oh no, well, we use the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for what should be used for diagnosing ADHD." And I said, "Oh, well, you mean these guidelines?" And I read to them and they said, "Yeah, but we don't cover that. All we need you to do is a couple of questionnaires and
mm-hmm,
that's all we're going to
right,
reimburse you for."
Mm-hmm.
And questionnaires have lots of limitations. They're great as part of a comprehensive evaluation, but in and of themselves to make a diagnosis, I mean, you know, if you're having a rough day, if a particular student or your child was having a particularly rough day and you filled out the questionnaire, then you're certainly going to score him differently than you would if, you know, he was absent
right,
from school that day, or if he was having a wonderful day or over at grandma's house for the day or something like that.
And I would say, you know, rating scales are useful tools.
Right.
A hammer is a useful tool, but not for screwing in a screw.
Right.
Okay. I can take my child to the pediatrician, and if she has an elevated temperature, if she has a fever,
right,
it might be the flu.
Right.
But I want to know whether it's the flu or an ear infection or meningitis.
Right.
Or a strep throat.
Right.
You know, so you know, just saying, well, we're only going to use rating scales, that's like saying, well, we're only going to use elevated temperature and then we're going to make a diagnosis
right,
based on, no, there are other things you
right,
have to do. It's the same with ADHD. There are other things. There's other information that you need to gather in order to make an accurate diagnosis.
Right.
You might get it right, but you might get it wrong.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's not just in the mental health field that this is the case,
right,
but we afford insurance companies and those kinds of funding agencies far too much authority
that's
to
right,
make decisions as it relates to how these things are identified. Because clearly,
mm-hmm,
you know, if you're a pediatrician, if you're a psychiatrist, if you're a psychologist,
right,
And you want to be reimbursed for an evaluation or for providing treatment for a patient, you have to give a diagnosis after at your first session.
That's right.
And so you have to, you know, even if you met with that person for, you know, an hour the first time for the first visit, you have to give a diagnosis no matter how
that's right,
confident or
even when
not
you
confident
don't want,
you are.
Even though you're not ready to make a
right,
formal diagnosis, you need to make a formal diagnosis in order
right,
to get reimbursed. So, yeah, there are some kinks in the system,
right,
some quirks in the system that we have to work around.
Right, and that certainly contributes to what they're talking about here
right,
with the fact that, you know, we have this increase in diagnosis. It's about 11% for
yeah,
students between the ages of, what, about 7 and 11 or so.
Right.
And there's some statistics mentioned in here that I got to look up that
right,
by the age of 15, the rate is even higher. So
right,
I really need to dig into this and look at that a little bit more. But the fact remains that the diagnosis is going to continue to increase in prevalence as long as we are limiting and restricting the way in which we can make the diagnosis and evaluate the diagnosis, and as long as we keep placing children in environments where they are required or expected to do things that are developmentally inappropriate.
I think it's the second one.
Be careful.
With what? Where am I going now?
Because we want to talk about school so bad.
No, it's the second point, I think. It's really, really important. According to the American Psychiatric Association, about 5% of children should have ADHD.
Right.
I mean, statistically, about 5%. But actually, the real rate is about twice that.
Right.
9 or 10 or 11%. So there's some reason why
about twice as many kids.
Right. Are being referred.
Diagnosed.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And diagnosed with this disorder. And many people say, well, it's the drug companies who are pushing this. I'm not sure that that's the...
That's
not the only problem.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's not just big drug companies, what we call pharma. I don't think it's just big drug companies. I think what's happening today is that we put kids into these highly competitive situations. In other words, my daughter's a senior right now. There's this mania, I don't know what other word to use, there's this mania of getting children into the right college.
Right.
You know, and it begins in high school with they have to take extra courses. I have people that I see in my practice, the school day is 7 periods long. They're taking 11 courses.
Right.
That means they're filling up the entire day, and they're taking 4 extra courses.
At home,
online,
internet-based. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know how anybody does that, but you're setting up a situation where you may need chemical enhancement in order to accomplish that task.
Right.
You know, I have another who's taking eight courses. She shouldn't be taking 8 courses.
Right.
And in order to do that, she may need to go on some kind of medication to maintain that schedule.
Right.
Okay? So as you refer to these, we create environments that invite this making a diagnosis because the kids, many children just can't keep up with it.
Right.
And so, well, if, you know, and I hear parents say, well, if my child's getting all B's or getting mostly B's, maybe if he had a little bit of help, he could get all A's. You know, so they reach for medication. Maybe he has a little ADD, and so I'll give my child some medication, and that'll get her over that hump, and she'll get all A's instead of all B's, which I think that's also a factor, is that I think schools have set up this, you know, you have to get all A's mentality, and parents are saying, well, what do I need to do for my child so that she gets all A's?
Yeah.
And stimulant medication's on the list.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is a systemic issue.
Right.
Because, you know, you want to be competitive to get into college. Mm-hmm. Well, to be competitive to get into college, you have to have a high GPA.
That's right.
Well, you
and
have
high
students.
SAT score.
You have students who, on a 4.0 scale, have a 5.2 GPA.
Right. That's right.
Because of taking, you know, dozen AP courses and multiple honors courses and it creates an imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
And colleges, you know, they're seeking to admit the strongest students. And so we're left in a scenario where, you know, okay, you're a B student, but we need to do everything we can to make you an A student
so that
you can, you know, go to
Because if you don't have a
university.
4.0,
right.
you know,
you don't
B,
have a chance.
If you have all Bs, you have a 3.0.
Right.
That's considered
That's
unacceptable.
Considered low.
Okay.
Right.
If you get all Bs. Okay.
Right.
If you get all As, it's a 4.0. That doesn't get you into many of the flagship universities around the country,
right.
not just in Florida, but all over the country. And so this drive for something 4 point plus, you know, up to 5 point, is also contributing. So you have the insurance companies, you have the drug companies, and you have high schools and colleges who are all creating this frenzy where parents say, well, this is another tool I can use, another approach that we can use to get my child to be more competitive.
Absolutely.
So
we need to, you know, if you're concerned about your child, and concerned that he or she may have ADHD or ADD or anything like that, you know, you need to take him to see somebody who is knowledgeable about the condition, you know, a child adolescent expert, and talk about it and talk about maybe most specifically, why you have the concern. Is it a concern because she's making B's instead of A's, or is it a concern because your child's saying, I just can't concentrate in class. I'm trying as hard as I can, and I can't focus, I can't concentrate, because that's a very different situation.
Exactly, yep.
So,
And also remember that even if you do make the decision to put your child on medication, you're still going to have to do all the other things that are recommended.
Right.
So what you may want to do is do all the other things first, and if they work, then you don't have to go to medication. But you're going to have to do them whether they're on medication. The medication itself isn't going to solve all the problems. So you're going to have to do all these other, you're going to have to make a number of other changes.
Absolutely.
So start with those changes first, and maybe you don't need to move on to medication.
That's right. Okay. So, all right. Well,
we'll talk more about that, though.
Yeah, we don't need to.
Yeah.
So, this is our last morning show for the week. So, we hope that you all have a great weekend. Get out there and exercise. Spend some time outside with your family, with your kids, and with your significant other. With somebody that you like being around. Whether it's your, we hope it's your significant other.
Or somebody who likes to be with you.
Somebody who likes to be hanging around with you.
If you can find one.
So have a great weekend, and we will see you again bright and early on Monday morning.
Have a great weekend.
All right. Bye-bye.